Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 471, Side A. It's titled Death Trap, and it's being recorded on August 1st of the year 2004. Before we get into the main subject of the broadcast, of course, the various programs and lectures I've done over the years are available from Spitfire, CD Duplication Service, Regular Mail, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit their website, www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed, annotated article-length description of For the Record 471 and the Spitfire website within a week or two of the airing of this program. Note that the descriptions often have information that are not included in the original broadcast. Spitfire website's equipped with a search function and also now features the landmark text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. Sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that site and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Listeners are emphatically encouraged to compile their own databases from the printed and audio files that are available on the Internet and to do as much as possible to not only preserve and archive the material but to disseminate it to others through various means. Now, the broadcast that we're now undertaking is a supplement to other programs that I've done. It's called Death Trap because, in my considered opinion, the United States is deeply imperiled. I believe that the current unpleasantness now unfolding in the U.S. and elsewhere is quite literally a continuation of World War II by an underground Reich, and literally a Third Reich that went underground and has preserved itself in mafia-like fashion and is using its classic tactics of fifth column activity at home combined with a hostile assault from abroad. That hostile assault, however, is using proxy warriors, the largely recruited now from the Muslim population of what the Nazis called the Earth Island, that vast landmass running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, former Soviet Union, India, China, and Pakistan. I have voiced my opinion in the past that I think this administration is literally a front for the underground Reich, and as I discussed in, among other programs, For the Record 412, that this administration is literally out to destroy the United States. I don't feel that all or even most of the people in that administration are necessarily of that conscious mind. A lot of the motivation is stupidity, greed, selfishness, ignorance, what have you, but there are some conscious plotters, and I believe that Karl Rove is the linchpin of this element, that are literally out to deep six the United States, the last major obstacle to world fascist domination. What we're going to be taking a look at in this broadcast is an hypothesis that I developed during the run-up to the Iraq War, namely that the U.S. was falling into a trap, that we had been baited into taking a step which would basically provoke us into an open and protracted conflict with the Muslim population of the Earth Island, those functioning as proxy warriors for an underground Reich. And again, not necessarily consciously in most cases. Most of the combatants are of the opinion that they are defending the Ummah, the Muslim community, against a plot from abroad. But what I'm going to ask you to do is to entertain the hypothesis that, in fact, the U.S. is undergoing what France went through in the run-up to World War II, when it was actively subverted from within. That's why the French resistance to World War II collapsed, to the Nazis in World War II, collapsed so quickly. They were subverted from within. This is an hypothesis that we're going to be developing in this broadcast. And again, recall the many, many warnings that I gave in the programs that I recorded in the run-up to the Iraq War, which was that, in my opinion, we were being provoked into it. We were being lured into a trap, and that we were going to find ourselves in an intractable war with the Muslim population of the Earth Island, and that if that did not physically result in the destruction of the United States, it was going to drain our resources. This is combined with an economic assault at home in which the Bush administration has absolutely plunged the United States into a sea of red ink, and that alone may very well destroy us. It certainly is going to reduce our options in the event of any one of a number of things, including a natural catastrophe or a triggered natural catastrophe, such as some of my fears about the possibility of an earthquake later this year, or another major terrorist incident as well. But I'm going to ask you to consider that this administration is actually a cat's paw for the deadliest enemies this country has ever had, and that, as I explained in For the Record 412, the engineer is out to wreck the train. As we're going to see in this broadcast, many intelligence analysts are now coming to the same conclusion that I had come to in the run-up to the Iraq War, which is that we were falling into a trap. We're going to begin by taking a look at a very eloquent and thoughtful column, one that I suspect is consciously intended to convey a lot more between the lines than what is actually written here, and there's plenty written. Some of the finest work in the country is being done by Paul Krugman, the economic columnist for the New York Times. And in the New York Times of July 20th of 2004, Paul Krugman had a column titled The Arabian Candidate, and it reads as follows. In the original version of the Manchurian Candidate, Senator John Eisland, whom Chinese agents are plotting to put in the White House, is a right-wing demagogue modeled on Senator Joseph McCarthy. As Roger Ebert wrote, the plan is to use anti-communist hysteria as a cover for a communist takeover, unquote. The movie doesn't say what Eisland would have done if the plot had succeeded. Presumably, however, he wouldn't have openly turned traitor. Instead, he would have used his position to undermine national security while posing as America's staunchest defender against communist evil. And again, I would suggest that this administration, while waving the flag and invoking super patriotism and maintaining an ostensibly martial stance, is actually undermining this country. It's undermining its democratic institutions. It's undermining its military. It's undermining its intelligence community. And the end result is going to be that this engineer is going to run the train off the tracks. Continuing with Paul Krugman's column. So let's imagine an update. Not the remake with Denzel Washington, which I haven't seen, but my own version. This time, the enemies would be Islamic fanatics who install as their puppet president a demagogue who poses as the nation's defender against terrorist evildoers. And we're going to now examine what Paul Krugman has in mind here. Bear in mind the line of inquiry that I've developed for so long, discussing the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bank al-Taqwa, in which all of the discernible monies that al-Qaeda was in possession of after September 11th were located. Bank al-Taqwa is run by Youssef Nada, a former Third Reich intelligence agent. One of his top aides is Ahmed Huber, himself a protege of Johann von Leers, in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' Third Reich. And Youssef Nada and Ahmed Huber were functioning as cutouts for François Genoux, the real driving force behind the founding of al-Taqwa. Genoux, one of the most important Third Reich intelligence agents and an operative for the Odessa, helped to move Nazi monies around after World War II, in addition to helping to facilitate the escape of Nazi war criminals. So as we're examining the rest of Paul Krugman's column here, sort of consider a Dave Emery template put over this, which is that behind the Islamist combatants that Paul Krugman's talking about here lies the underground Reich, using those Islamist combatants as proxy warriors, in a fashion very much the way they did in World War II, involving, among other things, three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions and other Islamist units in the Wehrmacht and the SS. Those recruited primarily by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the self-proclaimed Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, first founder of the Palestinian National Movement, by the way, and also a man whose escape was from Germany was aided by Youssef Nada, head of Bank al-Taqwa and one of the defendants in the trillion-dollar lawsuit by the survivors of September 11th. Now, about Paul Krugman's column here, or about his thesis about the Arabian candidate, and I would add behind the scenes the Islamo-fascist underground right candidate. The Arabian candidate wouldn't openly help terrorists. Instead, he would serve their cause while pretending to be their enemy. After an attack, he would strike back at the terrorist base, a necessary action to preserve his image of toughness, but botch the follow-up, allowing the terrorist leaders to escape. Once the public's attention shifted, he would systematically squander the military victory, committing too few soldiers, reneging on promises of economic aid. Soon, warlords would once again rule most of the country and the heroin trade would be booming and terrorist allies would make a comeback. Meanwhile, he would lead America into a war against a country that posed no immediate threat. He would insinuate, without saying anything literally false, that it was somehow responsible for the terrorist attack. This unnecessary war would alienate our allies and tie down a large part of our military. At the same time, the Arabian candidate would neglect the pursuit of those who attacked us and do nothing about regimes that really shelter anti-American terrorists and really are building nuclear weapons. Again, he would take care to squander a military victory. The Arabian candidate and his co-conspirators would block all planning for the war's aftermath. They would arrange for our army to allow looters to destroy much of the country's infrastructure. Then, they would disband the defeated regime's army, turning hundreds of thousands of trained soldiers into disgruntled potential insurgents. After this, it would be easy to sabotage the occupied country's reconstructions simply by failing to spend aid funds or rein in cronyism and corruption. Power outages, overflowing sewage, and unemployment would swell the ranks of our enemies. Who knows? The Arabian candidate might even be able to deprive America of the moral high ground. No mean trick when our enemies are mass murderers by creating a climate in which U.S. guards torture, humiliate, and starve prisoners, most of them innocent or guilty of only petty crimes. At home, the Arabian candidate would leave the nation vulnerable, doing almost nothing to secure ports, chemical plants, and other potential targets. He would stonewall investigations into why the initial terrorist attack succeeded, and by repeatedly issuing vague terror warnings, obviously timed to drown out unfavorable political news, his officials would ensure public indifference if and when a real threat is announced. Last but not least, by blatantly exploiting the terrorist threat for personal political gain, he would undermine the nation's unity in the face of its enemies, sowing suspicion about the government's motives. Okay, end of conceit. President Bush isn't actually an al-Qaeda mole with Dick Cheney his controller. Mr. Bush's war on terror, however, has played with eerie perfection into Osama bin Laden's hands, while Mr. Bush's supporters, impressed by his tough talk, see him as America's champion against the evildoers. Last week, Republican officials in Kentucky applauded bumper stickers distributed at GOP offices that read, "Kerry is bin Laden's man, Bush is mine," unquote. Administration officials haven't gone that far, but when Tom Ridge offered a specifics-free warning about a terrorist attack timed to disrupt our democratic process, unquote, many people thought he was implying that al-Qaeda wants George Bush to lose. In reality, all infidels probably look alike to the terrorists, but if they do have a preference, nothing in Mr. Bush's record would make them unhappy at the prospect of four more years. Well, again, in the background of al-Qaeda, we find the Muslim Brotherhood, Bank al-Taqwa, people like Baudin Dunant, co-chairman of the board of SECO, the European holding company for the al-Qaeda, for the bin Laden family's business interests. And then in the background of the Bush family, we also find a Nazi heritage. And again, I would suggest that, in fact, Paul Krugman's literary device here, his flight of literary fantasy, is actually much closer to the substance of things than perhaps even Paul Krugman believed here. Again, my expressed fear, expressed many times in programs in the run-up to the Iraq War, which is that we were falling into a trap which was going to result in the destruction of the United States, a combination of economic and political subversion at home, destroying our diplomatic relationships with other countries, and luring us into an endless war with the Muslim population of the Earth Island would result in the final solution to the American problem and to the, quote, Jewish problem, i.e. Israel. The Jewish problem was how the Nazis put it, and would also at the same time take out an awful lot of the Muslims and Arabs as well. And the Third Reich, despite their pretensions of alliance and their actual alliances with elements in the Muslim world, hate Muslims almost as much as they hate Americans and Jews. A column by a CIA analyst who has been writing anonymously also was carried in the New York Times. This actually is an article, I should say. It's not a column. The New York Times of June 23rd of 2004 had an article by Douglas Jahl, J-E-H-L. It's titled, "Book by CIA Officer Says U.S. is Losing Fight Against Terror," and this reads as follows. A new book by the senior Central Intelligence Agency officer who headed a special office to track Osama bin Laden and his followers warns that the United States is losing the war against radical Islam and that the invasion of Iraq has only played into the enemy's hands. In the book Imperial Hubris, unquote, the author is identified only as anonymous But former intelligence officials identified him as a 22-year veteran of the CIA who is still serving in a senior counterterrorism post at the agency and headed the bin Laden station from 1996 to 1999. The 309-page book, obtained by the New York Times, provides an unusual glimpse into a school of thought inside the CIA and includes harsh criticism of both the Clinton and Bush administrations. Quote, U.S. leaders refuse to accept the obvious, the officer writes. We are fighting a worldwide Islamic insurgency, not criminality or terrorism, and our policy and procedures have failed to make more than a modest dent in enemy forces, unquote. The author says the threat is rooted in opposition not to American values, but to policies and actions, particularly in the Islamic world. It's rare for a CIA officer to publish a book while still serving at the agency, and highly unusual for the book to focus on such a politically explosive topic. Under CIA rules, the book had to be cleared by the agency before it could be published. It was approved for release on condition that the author and his internal agency not be identified. The book itself identifies anonymous only as a senior U.S. intelligence official with nearly two decades of experience in national security issues related to Afghanistan and South Asia, unquote. It identifies a previous book, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America, as being written by the same author. Former intelligence officials identified the officer to the Times and noted that he was an overt employee of the CIA, but an intelligence official asked that his full name not be published because it could make him a target of Al-Qaeda. The senior intelligence official said the book had been vetted to ensure that it did not include classified information. We still have freedom of speech, the official said. It doesn't mean that we endorse the book, but employees are free to express their opinions, unquote. In a report issued in March, the staff of the September 11th Commission described the bin Laden unit as a place where, quote, a sense of alarm about bin Laden was not widely shared or understood within the intelligence and policy committees, unquote. Another new book, Ghost Wars, by Steve Call of the Washington Post, was based in part on interviews with the officer identified by his first name, Mike. Mr. Call reported that the White House sometimes complained to George J. Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, that the officer was too myopic, unquote, in his approach to manage the bin Laden group. In the book, the author denounced the American invasion of Iraq as, quote, an avaricious, premeditated, unprovoked war against a foe who posed no immediate threat, unquote, and said it would fuel the anti-American sentiments on which Mr. bin Laden and his followers draw, quote, there is nothing that bin Laden could have hoped for more than the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, he writes. In warning that the United States is losing the war on terrorism, Anonymous writes, quote, in the period since the 11th of September, the United States has dealt lethal blows to Al-Qaeda's leadership and, if official claims are true, have captured 3,000 Al-Qaeda foot soldiers, unquote. At the same time, he adds, we have waged two failed half wars and in doing so left Afghanistan and Iraq seething with anti-U.S. sentiment, fertile grounds for the expansion of Al-Qaeda and kindred groups, unquote. The bin Laden unit, or station in agency parlance, is part of the CIA's counterterrorism center. It was established in 1996 at the agency's headquarters in Virginia as part of an organizational experiment that marked the first time the agency had dedicated a station to an individual instead of a country. A staff report issued by the September 11th Commission in March, based in part on extensive interviews with the former station chief, described leaders of the station as having been deeply frustrated when a plan to capture bin Laden in the spring of 1998 was not recommended by the CIA's leadership for approval by the White House. The chief and other leaders of the bin Laden station were transferred from it in mid-1999, according to the September 11th Commission report, after morale in the unit sagged and President Clinton was informed by his national security advisor that covert actions against Mr. bin Laden had not been fruitful. In the book's preface, the author appears to direct criticism not only at policymakers, but also at his superiors in the intelligence agencies, including Mr. Tenet, who fended off criticism after the attacks before announcing this month that he would resign on July 11th. The author expresses, quote, a pressing certainty that Al-Qaeda will attack the continental United States again, that its next strike will be more damaging than that of September 11th, 2001, and could include the use of weapons of mass destruction. After the next attack, he adds, misled Americans and their elected representatives will rightly demand that the heads of intelligence community leaders roll. that heads did not roll after the September 11th attacks is perhaps our most grievous post-attack error. And another factor, too, by the way, in helping to dig a grave in this death trap that I'm talking about, I believe, as I talked about in For the Record 449, that the peace talks between the Israelis and the PLO were deliberately sabotaged, not only by elements associated with the GOP, but in particular with their allies in the Middle East, the Saudis, inextricably linked with the Bush family in terms of their history, their economic dealings, their political dealings, and also, of course, the profound history of the Saudis in aiding the covert operations which the elder George Bush presided over in the 1980s. I would also note that the Bush administration has been supporting the most right-wing Israeli elements and are doing so in part because of the profound influence of the Christian far right in this administration, and specifically Christian Zionist elements who were supporting the Israeli right wing, not because they're pro-Israeli or pro-Jewish, but because they see the restoration of Israel to its biblical boundaries as part of the realization of biblical prophecy in order to bring about the Battle of Armageddon, the annihilation of all Jews who have not converted to Christianity, and that would result in the second coming of Jesus. And again, the Bush administration has been deliberately supporting the most reactionary elements in Israel for, not again, not pro-Jewish or pro-Israeli reasons, but in order to basically precipitate the annihilation of Israel and the Jews. Again, a goal absolutely in keeping with the goals of the Third Reich. Situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating for reasons that Paul Krugman touched on and that were also touched on in that article about Anonymous. San Jose Mercury from Friday, July 30th of 2004, had the following story, a Knight Ridder article by Mark McDonald, headlined by the Mercury, Taliban and Al-Qaeda gain strength. Stateline Kandahar, Afghanistan, and reads in part, a violent resurgence of Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan is putting U.S. soldiers and international aid workers at risk, especially in the southern part of the country, the backyard and birthplace of the Taliban. U.S. military patrols are frequently coming under attack. Highway construction workers, foreigners, and Afghans have had their throats slit merely for tampering with Taliban flags placed along roadsides. Nearly 3 years after the U.S. military toppled the Taliban government in Afghanistan, it's increasingly obvious that the military effort has failed to fully defeat the enemy, which has regrouped and now threatens efforts to create a stable government there. Election workers are being abducted, shot, and beheaded. Voter registration sites are being bombed even when they're located at mosques. And now the Taliban has begun delivering ominous, quote, night letters, unquote, notes slipped to local officials warning them not to help with upcoming elections. The country's first ever presidential election is scheduled for October 9th, 3 months later than originally planned because of security worries, and parliamentary elections have been pushed back until April. So note that things are not going well in Afghanistan. That one had been put into the W column. It ain't in the W column anymore. I'm going to reiterate an element that I presented in several broadcasts, including For the Record 454 and For the Record 404. And this concerns the discussion of the links between the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Now, of course, the Bush administration hinted very directly that those links were much more profound than they were and indicated, again, not directly, but hinted pretty overtly that Saddam Hussein was connected to the September 11th attacks. This is not, in fact, the case, and there was no long-term operational link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda because there are profound differences between the Sunni fundamentalist Islamic Al-Qaeda and the secular Arabo-fascist Saddam Hussein, whose Ba'ath Party was sort of a mixture of Stalin's and Hitler's ideology. But there was, however, an arrangement between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda that was sort of a doomsday scenario. Despite the profound differences, which prevented any sort of serious long-term working relationship, the two did have a number of meetings organized through the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, and eventually an accommodation was worked out in which Al-Qaeda would sort of function as Saddam Hussein's doomsday backup unit in the event of a successful American overthrow of Saddam Hussein. This comes from some expert French intelligence sources, ones who are neither partisans of the Islamists, nor are they partisans of the chauvinist government of George Bush as well. So I view these accounts as credible. From the book In the Name of Osama Bin Laden by French counterterrorist intelligence official Roland Jacquard, not official, but expert, I should say. The Duke University Press published this in softcover. And of the doomsday backup scenario arrangement between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, quote, "It appears, however, that this version is only the publicly admissible one, the one that can pass political muster. According to the same sources, there was another scenario more in keeping with the calculating mentality of Saddam Hussein and his secret services. In 1998, after declining all offers that had been made to them through official diplomatic channels, those services are reported to have established a secret operational connection with bin Laden in Manila and Kashmir. It was indeed difficult for Iraq to ignore an Arab like Osama bin Laden, who, quote, so effectively humiliated the Americans, unquote. Colonel Khairullah al-Takriti, brother of the head of the Mukhabarat, the intelligence services, is reported to have been named case officer for the connection. The arrest of two Moroccan associates of bin Laden in Rabat on November 11, 1998, made it possible to establish the link with certainty. According to Western sources, the Iraqi services have sought to secure the assistance of bin Laden's networks in case Iraq were again to be attacked by the United States in order to carry out attacks against American targets in Arab countries," unquote. Again quoting, "According to Arab sources, in anticipation of foreseeable reversal of alliances in, of a foreseeable reversal of alliances in Kabul, bin Laden had been in discreet contact since September of 2000 with associates of Uday Hussein, another of Saddam's sons. The ground for agreement was the anti-Israeli and anti-American battle. Bin Laden and the Iraqis are said to have exchanged information about chemical and biological weapons, despite the opposition of some of the Baghdad leadership, including Tariq Aziz." So basically, we have fallen into a trap. And according to French counterterrorist expert Roland Jacquard, the accommodation between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with September 11th, but in the event that the U.S. attacked Saddam Hussein and knocked him off, al-Qaeda was going to function as a doomsday backup unit. And again, it looks as though we have been lured into just such a trap. We're going to take a look at some of the implications of this, including a very good article in Mother Jones magazine talking about how we fought the wrong war and just what this has done for the U.S. geopolitically. That, however, we will undertake in Side 2. Again, Spitfire, www.spitfirelist.com. Stocks all the lectures and CDs I've done over the years. I don't get money from them, but please do take advantage of that. Long written annotated descriptions of the For the Record shows in the Spitfire website within a week or two of the airing of the program. Spitfire website equipped with a search function and also has Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile available for download. Note also that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that site and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Listeners are emphatically encouraged to use the printed and audio material available online to put together their own archives and their own database and to disseminate the information as far and wide as possible. Who knows, this could become one of the last repositories where people can find out what happened to our civilization. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 471, Death Trap, being recorded on August 1st of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.